Take a network break. Sit back and relax with a virtual donut as we spin through this week's tech news. We'll dig into IBM's HashiCorp acquisition, new wireless APs from HPE, fear and loathing at TSMC chip fabs in Arizona, and more. We're joined by special commentator Kyler Middleton. Kyler is a cloud security chick and co-host of the Day 2 Cloud podcast on the Packet Pushers Network and a former HashiCorp ambassador, so we're excited to get her input. We're sponsored today by G-Core. G-Core has introduced FastEdge, a new product in low-latency edge computing for serverless app deployment built on WebAssembly. With FastEdge, your code runs closer to your users than ever before, leveraging a global CDN network of over 160 data centers to ensure lightning-fast performance. You can join the FastEdge beta today and transform how your apps are delivered. Visit gcore.com/packetpushers to learn more. That's gcore.com/packetpushers. And then stick around for today's Tech Bytes podcast, sponsored by HPE Aruba Networking. We're going to dig into Zero Trust Network Access, or ZTNA, and hear customer stories and how it's being used for third-party access, VPN consolidation, and protecting developer access to testing and QA resources. All right, to the news. IBM is acquiring HashiCorp for $6.4 billion in cash. HashiCorp makes infrastructure automation software, including popular tools such as Terraform and Vault. IBM says the acquisition is going to help drive growth in enterprise, hybrid, and multi-cloud alongside Red Hat.
This is an interesting one, Drew, because I think there's lots and lots of dimensions here that I would start off with. So let's start off with the financial angle first, because I think that's probably the main driver here. HashiCorp had a $14 billion IPO in 2021 and was trading at the IPO value of the company at $14 billion in 2021 and was trading at a valuation of about $4.7 billion just before the acquisition announcement. And so the IPO price was $80 and today it's around about $30. Just before the acquisition. So you can see here that the aspirations that HashiCorp had 4 years ago have been reset against reality of declining revenue or declining position in the market, and its forward value hasn't met up with the expectations that shareholders have, right? Uh-huh. And from my reading around here, and there's lots and lots of discussion, and I'll be interested to hear what Kylie says, the general perspective seems to be that after changing its license, revenue growth slowed substantially, and that future revenues won't support the current valuation, and its share price would absolutely drop in the months and years to come. So that makes selling now a serious issue. You're going to say, hang on, I can sell now for this, but I know that my revenue is shrinking, and I guess we don't think we can turn it around. So we'll sell and pocket the cash. Like if you're an investor in HashiCorp, what are you going to do? Take the money now or wait for it to maybe grow or maybe shrink, but probably shrink in the future? And the answer is you probably sell. How does that match with what you're thinking, Carla?
I think that's about right. When I've talked to practitioners, the prevailing opinion is, well, it was fun while it lasted, because open source has this powerful hold on the world to move mountains. You know, it's incredible what this open source stuff can do. And I feel like Hashi knew that, but maybe they didn't. But my theory that's based on nothing at all is that maybe IBM asked them to make this licensing change. But as soon as that happened, it was a foregone conclusion that someone would buy them, because when you move away from open source, you lose that ability to move mountains. And I think HashiCorp is seeing that.
So one of the things we've talked about, Drew, is open source projects, like they don't seem to get valued the same. They don't have a low valuation because people are getting for free. They don't appreciate what they're getting for free. And even though, I mean, look at projects like Nginx, MySQL, Linux, the whole Linux thing, right? Huge value for companies around the world. But getting them to pay, you know, a $300 a year license for each version of Linux they run, and they scream blue murder, like you've been stolen their toys and then beat their, you know, killed their cat and then stolen the keys to their car at the same time. You know, it's almost impossible to convince companies to pay for a free open source product, even though they're getting huge amounts of value out of it, like HashiCorp does, right? And we know that enterprises will happily pay for overpriced, overinflated, much worse products because they have real people selling it. You know, they can look at the vendors, you know, the brand name vendors around and their ability to close deals at vastly inflated prices. And, you know, they get away with it. So I don't know that enterprise values open source projects according to the value they extract from them.
Absolutely. At an earlier job, I deployed 80 Windows clients, like laptops and 10 servers, and I accidentally spent $4.5 million year over year just in Windows license fees. So enterprises will certainly pay for software that they see value in, but for some reason this whole field is sort of excluded from, like, I need to pay for it just because it's available for free. And I don't know the solution to that.
So do you feel like
it's like
Kyler,
you took their toys? It looked like you took their toys away. Like it was free. Now you've got to pay for it. That's perfectly reasonable, right? You had it for free. You got value out of it for ages. Now you should pay for it. But it's like, you know, there's this hissy fit and lying on the floor, banging their hands on the ground, going, "You took my toys away."
I think it was a very poor exercise in marketing. I think if you just say, "Hey, here's a widget," and then the next day, "Oh, hey, this widget that was free yesterday, I'm going to charge you money today." And you say, "Well, that's terrible. I'm not getting more widget for my money." But if they would have had some sort of story, some narrative that like, "Hey, we're going to make it cost money, but also here's something cool extra that you get." That's how every other product on the market works. So I think this was just doomed from the beginning. If you change the price of something and you don't improve what the product is, no one's going to be happy with that. I wouldn't be, and I'm not.
Do you have a sense, Kyler, of whether IBM is a good home for HashiCorp? Can they do something with it? Or at least not ruin it?
I think it's the least bad option that I have heard. I have heard a lot of fear that Oracle was going to acquire them and then potentially like kill them. I'm not thrilled with IBM acquiring them. We've seen some pretty poor stewardship of AWX, which is like Ansible Control Tower, and potentially also CentOS. There's been a lot of hubbub in the last year or two about how they've kind of nerfed CentOS open source, and I've seen a lot of migration away from there. So I'm skeptical that this will go well for the HashiCloud offerings, but we will see. I don't want to be too negative here. Maybe this will work great.
I mean, you sort of referenced this earlier. Maybe HashiCorp kind of got the bad news out of the way for IBM by making the license changes ahead of the acquisition so that IBM won't sort of get the hate it got for the changes it made with CentOS.
Absolutely. And that is entirely conjecture on my part. But imagine the alternative is HashiCorp stayed open source and then IBM bought them and said, "Oh, now we're going to make it closed source." They would just be hated by everyone that uses Terraform and Vault, which I swear is what, 80%?
Well, that's what they did with Red Hat, isn't it?
Absolutely. And maybe they learned from that experience where they became someone hated. And so they said, "Hey, Hashi, we will buy you, but you need to make that license change first because, you know, your brand is going to be diluted and go away when we buy you."
I guess the bigger question is, do you think people will or have started moving away from HashiCorp because of the license change? And this will affect IBM's ability to actually generate revenue from the acquisition? Or do you think people will be angry, but they'll continue to use it just because it's useful and it works?
I think almost everyone is in that second camp where they will keep using it and they'll just keep grumbling. But the Tofu project, the Open Tofu, which is the open source version of Terraform that split off, has 20,000 stars as of yesterday on GitHub. So there is a ton of momentum building behind the open source projects. I think we're going to see a slow attrition from the licensed IBM version of Terraform to Open Tofu and Open Vault, which is, I think, called OpenBow now, just towards the open source projects, because there is so much value in those freely available tools that are so powerful.
My point would be is that people should want to pay for it, right? It's perfectly viable to say this product needs to evolve and to go on. Like, if you look at OpenTofu, it may have some momentum behind it today, but will it still have that momentum in 2 years? And HashiCorp will have money, or, you know, as IBM will still be, you know, innovating on the product or working on the product and extending it into various directions. And if OpenTofu doesn't continue to add those, then customers will eventually want to switch out anyway. And I think it's going to get harder to manage these clouds. So if I'm AWS or Azure or Google, right, I think they would never have made good buyers of HashiCorp, right? Because, well, they're not opposed to multi-platform tools like Terraform, but they would much rather build proprietary closed systems that people are locked in. So every time you work with AWS or Azure or Google, they're always producing a new thing, but it's proprietary. It's unique to them, right? And so, but everybody says, "Oh, we want to be multi-cloud." So you need a multi-cloud tool chain to do all of that. And that's why AWS, Google, or Azure wouldn't have been a good buyer for this. And there was a couple of other buyers who people were talking about. Broadcom was one, which of course has got its hands full with VMware. And Cisco's been a major partner of HashiCorp. And what I think has been happening is they've been looking at HashiCorp and going, "We don't want to buy you because of your open source, because we can't extract enough revenue from it unless you actually own the license that you have." And I think at some point they've said like, "Well, okay, we've been trying to sell the company. We know our revenue is not going to grow to meet the valuation that we have. We have to make this licensing change because all of our potential acquirers that we've had discussions with have said you have to shift away to a closed license, because who wants to pay $6 billion for HashiCorp and then AWS just says, oh sure, we're just going to fork it, make our own version, like they did with some other products, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
My assumption is that the customers IBM is going after are not going to be the ones going to OpenTofu anyway, so they're not really worried about that.
Yeah, the customers I've worked with feel that the open source version is too nascent, and so it's therefore a substantial risk to adopt any kind of enterprise processes and tooling around it. Whereas the one from Terraform, now IBM, is just stable, solid, proven, supported by an enterprise company. So I agree, the enterprise view is probably going to take the hit and grumble and start paying for the product.
Which is not unreasonable. It's a good product. It's worth money. It's got value to enterprises. And I'll bet you that if IBM turns up with a sales rep and is going to buy steak dinners and got a complicated licensing scheme that someone needs a certification to understand, enterprises are going to love it. They're going to think this is the duck's guts, because that's what they do with everything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
I was looking through the earnings call transcript, and the CEO of IBM said HashiCorp lets IBM go on the offensive to attract clients that are moving toward hybrid and multi-cloud. One of the analysts on the call also asked about, Red Hat as a VMware alternative. And they said, yeah, we're definitely thinking about, HashiCorp gives them advantages for managing infrastructure that could then lead to folks wanting to get into the Red Hat OpenShift environment as well as a VMware alternative. So I think IBM is seeing opportunity here to actually grow their interactions with customers with this software.
I think that's in multiple dimensions. HashiCorp as a cloud services overlay. So you can use Terraform, and Vault and all the things that go around the Terraform ecosystem to replace Kubernetes, to orchestrate VCF, to orchestrate tools in AWS and Azure and Google. And so all of a sudden, IBM can position itself as, we're an infrastructure company that's multi-cloud, and we own this product and control its direction for it. So now they can start to sell services off the back of it, because their services revenue is falling away. They're not selling as much services as they used to be. The consulting revenue is falling away. So this can be positioned as a big strategic play. We can come in, Mr. Fortune 500 company, and we can advise you on end-to-end Fortune, multi-cloud orchestration and engines and all that sort of stuff. Which is worth noticing that while IBM's made an offer, it could come up with a counter offer. And to my mind, Cisco's probably the only company who could be well positioned because it is a Switzerland. It doesn't represent a threat to anybody, particularly, more than IBM is, at least. I think Broadcom's too busy with VMware, but Cisco may come up with a counter offer. I mean, they've been a bit spendy lately, Drew. They bought Isovalent, they bought Splunk. They need something to be multi-cloud. They're playing on the security angle with their recent Hypershield announcement, and that's probably why they bought Isovalent. So if Cisco bought a hold of this, could it, possible, do you think?
I don't think so. One, because they spent so much money on Splunk that I don't know that investors would be up for another acquisition, particularly given they also got Isovalent, which is not necessarily in the same camp as HashiCorp, but does give them a position in the container world. So maybe, but maybe just to take it away from IBM, I guess, $7 billion is not a lot to Cisco, but yeah, I don't see them putting up a counter offer.
I don't know. It's just an idea. It's worth noting. It's an offer.
Absolutely.
It's not a done deal.
It totally is. Maybe they'll do it just to screw around with IBM and make them pay more. I don't know.
So one more thing on the open source front, HashiCorp is possibly the last tech company that used open source as a low cost marketing tool at launch. Remember about 10 years ago, it was like all the fashion for a company to spawn an open source project, build a community, and not have salespeople, right? And there was a whole bunch of companies from that era who went out there and built products, and venture capitalists would then come along and fund them. And because they didn't have sales and marketing, these companies had really, really low overheads, but they had to hire community managers, right? And what's happened in that 10-year period is venture capitalists and private equity companies have realized open source is not a good way to do business. AWS can come along and gazump you. You don't actually own your core product. You share it with it. You can't set the direction. You can't turn up the price because customers, if you're getting something for free, as we talked about before, if you're getting something for free, you can't turn up the profit margin if you think you can extract more juice from that lemon, sort of thing. So I think this might be the last of the we released an open source product and they turned it into, you know, a $4 billion business, you know, selling it out of $6 billion. Still no mean effort. But I don't think private equity or venture capitalists are funding that model anymore. And I don't think we'll see much of it going forward, except under exceptional circumstances, you know. But yeah, is that reasonable?
I think so. And I hope we continue to have these sort of freemium models where the product is available for using just for the ecosystem's sake. The ecosystem of people learning to use the tool before they get to the enterprise level, because that's how a lot of folks get exposure to these tools, is you install it with Brew, you install the free version, and it's somehow limited technically, but you can still use the tool and get good at it before you use it in an enterprise environment. So I hope that stays the same and we don't abandon that as well when we move away from these free open source style growth patterns.
Yeah, see. So my cynical reaction to that is, oh, geez, that's nice. That's so sweet. That would be nice. But companies, you know, especially in this current era, you know, technology companies want to earn all the money. They would much rather put it into a community program, which is rigidly controlled. And there's a community management team who've got definite marketing goals attached to, you know, how many people are in my training community or my learning community and how many of them have got licenses. Like, you know, we've seen the vendors create these community sites, suck in all the stuff that used to be on blogs and Reddit and, you know, on Twitter, and put it into their managed platforms with their community managers, making sure that they've got complete control of what the customer, the messaging the customer sees and the messaging and all that sort of stuff. And so people get into the vendor certification track, right? And the vendor keeps control of what's happening out there. And I think that is the way that we're in, you know, that's the running for the next 5 to 10 years. Probably, sadly, mm-hmm. a bit sadly.
Yeah, I think so too.
So my last take is one more note from the earnings call. The CFO of IBM said, just a quarter of HashiCorp customers result in more than $100,000 annual recurring revenue, underscoring the opportunity to better monetize and upsell the products. I.e., I think that's a signal that IBM may be raising the money or knocking on your door with a sales rep and a consultant in tow to get those consultant engagement numbers up.
Yeah, 82% of the revenue came from 19% of customers
yeah.
who were buying over 100,000 a year. In yeah. other words, the gap between zero and 100,000 was very, very large. Yes. So, yeah.
One more note.
And IBM's proven a model out with Red Hat, and I suspect that will continue.
Yeah. For sure. One more note, Ned Belavance, who also co-hosts the Day 2 Cloud podcast with Kyler and is also a HashiCorp ambassador, was very excited to talk about this topic, but couldn't be here with us today. But he does have another podcast called Chaos Lever, a weekly news podcast that he hosts with Chris Hayner. They discuss technology. So if you're looking for even more perspective on this and other things, we recommend checking out Chaos Lever. It's at chaoslever.com. All right, moving on. HPE has announced a new wireless access point that supports the Wi-Fi 7 standard. The 700 series APs come with new features, including dual Bluetooth or Zigbee radios to support IoT devices, link level MACsec encryption, and double the SDRAM and flash memory as compared to prior models. HPE says you can use these resources to run containers directly on the APs if you want to run apps for use cases like pre-processing sensor data to respond to events more quickly.
I like what's happening in the wireless industry. You know, once upon a time, and they just produced the APs and they were very closed and very niche. And what we're starting to see is the Wi-Fi industry catch up with the rest of the market, right? And this idea that you can run a container on a wireless access point, or, you know, you've got a lot of open capabilities there. It's not just Wi-Fi now. They're talking about Bluetooth, Zigbee, link level MACsec. They've got enough SDRAM and flash to be able to do something serious. Whereas before, the wireless companies used to, and not just HPE, but all of them, used to nickel and dime you. You know, if I could save 15 cents by buying a cheaper CPU, I would do that, right? If I could use half the memory and save a dollar, I'd do that. Whereas now they're saying, like, let's make these things much more of a platform. So I think that's much more interesting to me than the fact that Wi-Fi 7 is here. I don't find Wi-Fi 7 inspirational or market changing. It feels like, you know, you add some spectrum, you add some extra signaling, you know, fine, whatever.
Yeah, I think so too. Just one note before we continue with the story, Kyler's got to drop. So I just wanted to say thank you, Kyler, for joining us. We love the commentary and we'll hope to have you back.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right, go hear Kyler on Day 2 Cloud. Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, we've seen some big jumps in the Wi-Fi standard, including 6E. I think 7 is just one of those, like, Just a few little extras that come on with each development, not like a groundbreaking one. But of course, vendors love to sell the latest and greatest. So all of them are going to be rolling out Wi-Fi 7 APs at some point. These are expected to ship in July 2024. One thing I did notice in the announcement, HPE says the APs will improve their location precision to within 1 meter. They do this by using a combination of having a receiver for the global navigation satellite system in the AP and a barometric sensor for, quote, floor level mapping. So I guess if you need to get very precise, you can start measuring barometric sensors. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, they're great, right? But it's fairly niche use case. And then, you know, like the Wi-Fi server improves the mesh networking capabilities. And there's, you know, in countries where it's legal, you can use 6 gigahertz and, you know, all those things. But I think for the majority of people, and the majority of use cases, the difference between Wi-Fi 5, 6, and 7 is probably fairly small, unless you've got a really, you know, highly dense, or you've got a services added, you know, as you say here, the user tracking or something like that.
Yeah,
I'm not entirely convinced that the Wi-Fi standard is focused on customers, or is it focused on itself? So, you know,
I think, you know, in your typical carpeted enterprise, do you need to be in a rush to get Wi-Fi 7? Probably not. If you're in, you know, manufacturing or a place with lots of IoT sensors, and maybe you want that precise location tracking to keep track of assets and so on, maybe it's worth it, but probably not a rush for most folks.
I guess having a GPS system in your AP is really useful to say, where is it? Because, you know, sometimes you don't know where they are. And so if you've got a GPS telling you it's in this building, well, at least you know it's in that building. And maybe depending on whether the signal can punch through the building, right, which is not necessarily a given, but, you know, you can actually say it's on the right-hand side or the left-hand side, you know, the north wing or the east wing of the building. There's value in that. But is it worth, you know, upgrading your network to achieve it? I'm less certain of that.
Yeah, I think so. I also wonder if that GPS capability is attached to the Automated Frequency Coordination Service, or AFC, which is something that's attached to the 6 gigahertz standard, because this is a mix of licensed and unlicensed spectrum. So you need to have precise location if you're going to use the full spectrum of 6 gigahertz without interfering with licensed operators. So I'm assuming there's something to that. If you've got any insights on that, we'd love to get to an FU, packetpushers.net/FU for follow-up.
Yeah, fairly sure that Keith over at Heavy Wireless would be talking about this and he would know more. So Heavy Wireless is a wireless podcast on the Packet Pushers Network. You should go and subscribe to that.
Yeah, the guy who runs it, Keith, also runs the WLPC, the Wireless LAN Professionals Conference, which wireless folks love. So check it out. All right, moving on. A data center operator has announced plans to build new data centers outside Dublin, Ireland. They're going to provide up to 52 megawatts of capacity. And given power constraints in Ireland, the company is also building its own power generation plant, which it says it can run partly on hydrogenated vegetable oil.
Okay, so we've been talking about Ireland as an example of where the national electricity grid is running out of capacity.
Yes,
and particularly in Ireland, there was permits for 22 data centers approved, and they've now all been rescinded. And what's unique here is that the company Vantage Data Centers is building a data center with 100 megawatts of its own power generation, but not in a way that I was expecting. Basically, what they're doing is including on-site 100 megawatt, or as they call it, MVA, so megavolt amps, which is kind of it's the same as megawatts for all intents and purposes, multi-fuel generation plant capable of running a combination of fuels, primarily hydro-treated vegetable oil, renewable fuel, and gas fed by the Gas Networks Ireland. So they're basically installing diesel generators. So HVO is basically a way of taking vegetable oil. Sometimes it's recycled vegetable oil, so vegetable oil that's used out to prepare foods and so forth and collected.
Yep.
But in other cases, it just comes directly. So it's farmed and then they treat it with water and hot water and high pressure, and it turns it into a sort of a version of diesel oil. So the thing that I would note here is that the campus initially starts with one 32 megawatt and then another 20 megawatt facility, and then it has available land and power to add a third through. So it's not, you know, there's a bit of manifesting going on here. You know, we're going to be 100 megawatts eventually if we can sell it and build it and all that stuff, right?
Right.
So I think the trick here is that they're calling it green. I don't know if you've researched HVO very well, Drew, but it's basically a replacement for fossil diesel, right?
Yeah.
And while it produces less pollution than fossil diesel, if you've got no HVO, Drew, what are you going to do?
You're going to run the diesel.
you're going to run the diesel, right? And yep. So then you've got all the pollution. So if I was Ireland and I was looking at this, I'd be going like, you've got obligations to only run HVO on this. Now, they seem to be getting some sort of gas generation as well, and they've signed up the suggestion is that they've signed up a supply agreement for a gas supply to be able to power these. But these are not being powered by green energy. Gas is not green. It is fossil fuels. They extract the gas from, you know, the fuel oil from, you know, the stuff they take out of the ground, and then they burn it. So it is not green. And HVO, the problem with HVO is it's very limited. You just don't have access to that much oil to be able to convert it into HVO diesel. And so what usually ends up happening is people take the HVO and run mineral diesel, and then you get the toxic pollution that comes out of those generators. And it is super bad. The amount of particulate matter and fumes that comes out of 100 megawatts of generation is something to be really worried about. So, but still, proves a point, Drew. If you want to build a data center, you now have to build your own power generation. And I expect to see more stories like this across the world.
Yeah, I think so, because we are taxing national electricity grids with all this data center construction. Here in the US, we also have a similar issue. There's lots of talk about ethanol as an alternative fuel source. But when you dig into it, the cost of actually producing the ethanol and the mechanisms used to produce it sort of wash out whatever quote unquote green benefits you'd get from using ethanol as a replacement for traditional gasoline. So yeah, this does seem like a little bit of a playing on the margins of trying to greenwash this. I think it is interesting that data center construction is now going to have to come with its own power source, whatever that is.
Yeah, I have a diesel engine. I'd love to run it on HVO, but here in the UK, but I can't get HVO supply.
Right.
You would have, you just can't.
There's only so many chip shops you can get the oil from, I assume, right?
Well, it just hasn't scaled up yet, right? And and you can buy a 20-liter box, but it's, you know, that's not really moving the needle when you've got a 100-liter fuel tank, right? Yeah. You don't want to go and buy five boxes of diesel and then manually put, you want to be able to go to a pump and say, no, I don't want fossil diesel, I want HVO diesel, and away you go. So unless they've got a whole farm and a factory right next door producing HVO, I'm not 100% sure how that works. So
I do wonder, though, if working in that data center, you would be constantly plagued by the smell of like French fries. If they're burning that vegetable oil.
HVO doesn't, it doesn't burn.
Doesn't have a smell.
No. You don't smell it. No, when it's, I won't digress too far, but basically they do something to the vegetable oil to basically turn it into diesel fuel.
I see.
And that process gets rid of all of the extra stuff so that it doesn't actually smell like what it was originally made of.
Okay. So you wouldn't be tormented by the smell of chips all day.
Well, there was a time there where people would go to the chip shop and just put the oil straight into the diesel tank. You know, filter it to get out all of the solids, but otherwise just throw it. And you can do that on certain older diesel engines that are not too modern. But
that's right.
Then it definitely did smell like a chip shop.
All right, a quick break to tell you about our sponsor, G-Core. They're introducing FastEdge. This is a new product in low-latency edge computing for serverless app deployment built on WebAssembly. With FastEdge, your code runs closer to your users than ever before, leveraging a global CDN network of over 160 data centers to ensure lightning-fast performance. Deploy your applications in minutes, code in your preferred language, and enjoy a secure serverless environment that scales automatically. It's simpler and faster than ever to build and deploy AI applications, image optimization services, and personalized web experiences. You can join the FastEdge beta today and transform how your applications are delivered. Visit gcore.com/packetpushers to learn more. With FastEdge, the future of edge computing is here and it's ready to power your next big idea. That's gcore.com/packetpushers. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission has banned non-compete clauses that make it harder for employees to change jobs. The FTC estimates that 30 million American workers are under non-competes currently.
Yeah, I think the main angle here, Drew, is that if you are working for an American company, there was some expectation for a while that you would sign a non-compete. And it wasn't the company that was taking the risk here. So what would happen is the company would say, if you quit, you can't work for one of our competitors, and we decide who the competitor is at the time that you leave. But we're not going to pay you. You just get stuck with the cost. And the FTC is basically saying that that's not acceptable. Preventing employees from making a living is actually a restriction of freedoms. I know of several companies who used to do non-competes by default. Obviously, they don't do them in California. But EMC was rumored to have based its head office in Boston almost completely on the basis that non-competes were legal there. And if you left EMC, you could never go and work for another storage company, more or less, without taking at least 6 months off, right? However, if the company can still give you a non-compete, provided they continue to pay you. So if you resign from the company and they put you on, you know, what people colloquially know as gardening leave for 6 months and they're still paying you a salary, then that is still legitimate. But for most of us who work for companies and the company says, no, you can't leave and go to a competitor because you're signing a non-compete when you come on board, I think this is good for them. Because if you're unhappy in a job, you can go on to the next one. Or if the company's got you by the short girlies and making your life miserable or making you do work you don't want to do, but you can't leave because you're trapped by the non-compete and you can't live without money for 6 months, this seems reasonable.
Absolutely. The FTC says non-competes are going to remain in place for senior executives that currently have them, but new non-competes will not be allowed for senior executives. So I guess if you change jobs, you can get under a new non-compete. The FTC also notes that employers are still allowed to enforce non-disclosure agreements with employees, and the FTC estimates that 95% of workers with non-competes also have NDAs. So I'm not sure how that will work out, what an NDA would encompass, and whether companies would want to go after you under the NDA if they decide to take vengeance. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it's reasonable that if you're a key employee and you own key secrets or key material information about a company, that the expectation is that you wouldn't go to a competitor then promptly use that. And that's not unreasonable
to
some extent.
Reasonable depending on how much they want to enforce it.
Yes, that's right. So it's not like they're going to go after everybody. I think it has to be worthwhile having a court case and chasing after it.
Yeah.
And that's where the executive parts come in. But for an ordinary employee who's working on an ordinary sort of a salary, you know, 50 to 150K, to sign an NDA and take all of the cost of that, and the company gets all the advantage and they don't pay for it, is fundamentally what the FTC was calling out here. And
Yeah, I think it's a good move. Happy to see it. All right, moving on. We've been talking a lot about TSMC. That's the Taiwanese chip manufacturer. They're building new fabs in the United States, including the U.S. state of Arizona. And as it's doing it, the company's grappling with cultural and language barriers. There's a really good article from a website called Rest of World that digs into issues such as a lack of English speakers on TSMC's side, a lack of Mandarin speakers among U.S. workers, clashes over work-life balance, rigid corporate hierarchies within TSMC that rankle U.S. engineers, and more.
Now, the Rest of the World's an interesting website. It looks at stories that you don't see elsewhere. And this one is because we've been following the TSMC factory at Arizona on and off for, what, 3 or 4 years, I think?
I think, yeah.
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah. And I think that understanding the supply chain is a useful skill to decode when an executive or a CEO is manifesting some sort of future. You know, like, my future is going to be covered in unicorns and pink roses, you know, all that sort of stuff. And you want to go like, well, where's the truth, right? So I would say in this case, what's happened is over the last 30 years, we've seen globalization of business practices, and most companies across the world operate in the same. There's a convergence on a way to do business, and most organizations in particular verticals operate a certain way. So, you know, certain industries are creative and empowering your employees and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, executives have often been given delegated responsibility, and that's been shown to have, you know, this sort of thing. But TSMC is a manufacturing company, not a technology company, right? It doesn't create technology. It manufactures to the absolute precisest possible scale. And I can't imagine, Drew, that there's much room for creativity or freedom of thought when you're manufacturing. The machinery just doesn't want creativity or things to change. It just wants to machine, right? So I don't understand. You know, like, if you're working for them, you're not free to make a change. You're not. TSMC has been doing this, and they're one of the best in the world. How can you possibly say or think that, they don't think like we do? You know, it's like, hang on. It doesn't make sense.
I guess some of the things I took away from the article were, like, it sounded like sometimes there's make work that you don't actually need to do, but they just want to make sure everybody is always working constantly. And so they'll think up things for you to do. It doesn't sound like it's easy for ideas to travel up the chain, which I guess for, you know, American engineers used to a little bit more fluidity could find that frustrating. I thought it was interesting because, you know, if you talk to a European, Americans, you know, look like they're overworked. But then TSMC shows up in Arizona and is like, you Americans are lazy. What is going on here?
you got to feel like that, right? Because the TSMC workers typically work 12-hour shifts, six days a week.
Right.
And they work like 6 days on, 5 days off or something, like some outright, you know, and they work night shifts because those manufacturing plants work 24 hours a day, of course. And
right.
So I just think that, you know, it's just funny. We used to see those stories all the time. You remember the days of Toyota saying we manufacture and Six Sigma and just in time. And that was a revolution. But TSMC, yes. You just don't see these culture clash stories so much these days. And that's one of the things that called it out to me is that, you know, wouldn't want to be in that situation, but it does seem fun to me that after, you know, 30 years of globalization, we still got culture clash stories.
Absolutely. I think it's a constant reminder that layer 8 can be just as much a challenge as the technology itself. All right, moving on. Cogent Communications has announced a scheme to securitize its IPv4 addresses, which it prices at a value of $206 million. And I think what this means is that Cogent is turning these IPv4 addresses into like collateral that can use for loans or something.
I had to do some ChatGPT to explain some of the terms in here, right? So let me try and explain this to you. Basically, Cogent is sitting on 38 million IPv4 addresses. And it needs money. It wants to fund. So normally it would go out into the market and seek a loan and pay an interest rate. And what Cogent is doing is they're creating a special purpose bankruptcy remote, indirect, wholly owned subsidiary of the company, and pricing 206 million of aggregate principal secured internet protocol version 4 address revenue term notes. Did you get all that? Basically, what it's doing is it's creating a company, putting in a certain number of IPv4 addresses. It doesn't say how much of them. Mm-hmm. Those IPv4 addresses generate revenue. So you can buy into that bond and the notes will repay you over an anticipated repayment term of 5 years. And so basically it's a financial loan secured by some number of IPv4 addresses with the interest paid from revenue generated from leasing them to Cogent's customers, right? Mm-hmm. So you sort of go out and dig in. So revenue term notes is a debt security. They're backed by a specific revenue stream, such as a project's cash flows or a dedicated sort of revenue stream. Special purpose vehicle means, in this case, a vehicle or a company specifically created for the purpose. And bankruptcy remote says that even if Cogent goes under, it's a remote from the core business. So this is a fully secured asset that you could go and buy into. So if you've got 206 million or some part of it, Drew, you could go and invest in this bond potentially and get revenue from IPv4 addresses that Cogent owns. So yay.
Okay. And I guess well done, ChatGPT, for helping us suss this out.
Yeah, I just hadn't seen some of these terms and I wanted to make sure I understood correctly. I think the interesting part here is that this is actually securitizing, which means, you know, basically creating a company which you could potentially do anything with, listed on the stock exchange and say, it's got $1 billion worth of IPv4 addresses in it. That's its value.
Right.
And you could rent those IPv4 addresses out and that's its revenue. There you go. Buy shares in my company. That's fundamentally what they're doing here, right? Almost, except they're doing it as a loan and then they're securing it with IPv4 addresses. I think this is just sort of a bit of an inflection point for IPv4 and sort of this idea that IPv4 addresses are worth money, to the point when a company like Cogent saying, well, we've got a massive asset after just acquiring Sprint, which gave them another 19 million addresses or something. Mm-hmm. We can use those to generate cheap loans. By offering them up. So there you go. It's just not something that I thought I would ever see.
Yeah, everyone not migrating to IPv6 is helping Cogent run this business. So congrats.
Astonishing, really. Anyway.
Yeah. I guess, you know, if you got it, you might as well use it. Otherwise.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it's either that or you could, you know, mostly you see this done with land.
Right.
I've got a plot of land that I own. Well, I could put that into a security and then say, I will pay this much rent on that land in the next 5 years, you know, buy into my bond that I've created around this. But this time, instead of land, it's IPv4 addresses. It just blows my mind, considering that we used to just get them for free 20 years ago.
I wonder if we'll see other big holders of IPv4 doing this. There's an opportunity. All right, our last story for the day, we talked about IBM buying HashiCorp earlier in the show. Big Blue also announced financial results for its first fiscal quarter of 2024. The company took in revenues of $14.5 billion, up 1% year over year. Net income was $1.6 billion. By business unit, software revenues were $5.9 billion, up 5.5%, including Red Hat, which was up 9%. Consulting revenues of $5.2 billion were essentially flat. Infrastructure revenues of $3.1 billion were down by 0.7%.
Yeah, so modest. I think this sort of talks into why they're buying HashiCorp. Consulting revenues are flat. Infrastructure revenues are down. That's mostly to do with the legacy part of the business. And as Drew said, Red Hat was up. they need more growth than that to justify their reason for existing. And so the only way they're going to do that is to go and acquire a business. I think it's fairly, I don't think you'd get too much argument that IBM can't grow organically. It can't go out and build a new product, or it can't go to customers and find new customers. Customers have, you know, migrated onto clouds. They didn't migrate onto mainframes, you know, or whatever. And so IBM needs to find a new revenue stream, and HashiCorp is it. And these results, to my mind, sort of reinforce that perspective.
Yeah, first, I'm astonished that in one quarter, IBM can get consulting revenues of $5.2 billion, and that's their second biggest business unit. That is astonishing. That is wow. The second thing is, when reading the earnings transcript call, you can see that they are just like holding on to those Z systems and being like, AI, it's going to save us. We got these Z systems. It's all going to work together. It's going to be great. Revenues are going to take off any minute now. I can feel it.
It's hard to know. I think IBM's a very interesting business in the sense that it's full of technologies. It's a fine company in the sense that, you know, mainframes, PCs, software, it's got application suites and all that type of stuff. But, you know, it's still got infrastructure revenues of $3.1 billion in the quarter. So it's still out there selling servers and routers and switches and stuff like that. You know, where else do you get money from? How do you grow? IBM can't just say, I'm this size and, you know, I'm zero growth. That doesn't work in the current marketplace.
Not at all. Yeah. Yeah. So I do think they are hoping that software can be a growth business for them. And that was very much part of the conversation in the earnings transcript call. All right. That wraps up the news portion of the show. Stick around for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation. We're going to be talking with HPE Aruba Networking about zero trust network access. It's coming right up. Zero Trust Network Access, or ZTNA, is a core element of a security service edge because it enables secure remote access to on-prem and cloud-based applications. On today's Tech Bytes podcast, sponsored by HPE Aruba Networking, we're going to dig into ZTNA from HPE's perspective and hear customer stories about how it's being used for third-party access, VPN consolidation, and protecting developer access to testing and QA resources. Our guests from HPE Aruba Networking are John Spiegel, Director of Network Transformation, and Jay Tilson, Director of Strategy. Folks, welcome to Tech Bytes. Let's start with some level setting. A lot of people are talking about zero trust network access. I feel like it can kind of be a lot of different things. I want to hear what you, how you're defining zero trust network access, ZTNA, and how it's deployed in HPE Aruba Networking's SSE offering.
Yeah, ZTNA, it's a hot topic right now. HPE, when we went to market with this product, we bought a company called Access Security. They started with basically ZTNA being the foundation of their product, was really the start of it. It is core to the product. And really what it's about is least privileged access to applications and data, and looking at how we deliver applications from really setting a calculus. It's really about the identity. It's about the posture of the device, and then adding in other factors like location, time of day. Is this application something that somebody should be accessing from home or being accessing from work, really running all of that together, coming out with an outcome, and then making a decision? So in terms of our product, it is the foundation. Everything that we add onto it afterwards, call it a SWIG, DLP, CASB, digital experience monitoring, they're really features.
Okay, so ZTNA is at the foundation. So you mentioned a couple of things, identity, sort of device context, posture, location, the kind of application they're accessing. How is all that information being gathered? Is there a client? Are there other ways to get this information to understand what policy needs to be applied?
Absolutely. So we look at it, our first point of view when we started the product was agentless. We saw a huge need for third-party security, access like contractors. Maybe it's the gentleman that does the HVAC, those types of things. Mm-hmm. That's a major category for breaches, access into the network, or over privileges. So we really started there with an agentless solution and then realized, you know, that wasn't enough. So we developed an agent-based solution as well. The unique thing about the agent-based solution is it supports all ports and protocols. So even the most difficult ones for ZTNA, and that's server-initiated protocols, whether that's voice over IP, server patching, peer-to-peer type traffic, those types of things, we support it. We leave no application behind.
Okay. And then how about identity? Are you tying into some kind of identity store?
So yeah, we support all of the major known identity providers. We leverage what they already do. So businesses don't need to go ahead and set anything up independently. Anything that's really SAML 2.0 we work with. But we also have our own identity provider built in. So for cases such as M&A, if you're acquiring a company and you want to quickly give access rather than tying two networks together and you want to give users access, you can put users in our identity provider. It's not there to compete against the kind of the big giants in the space, but it's there to give quick and simple access for anybody that you don't want to facilitate in your particular IDP.
And then what about enforcement points? How am I making sure access is enforced?
Access is enforced at our points of presence. We work differently to a lot of the other vendors. So we have single points of presence for all of the features of SSE. As John mentioned, we started off with ZTNA and added SWG, CASB, et cetera, et cetera. But all of our POPs do all of our features, and they are the enforcement point. And they are built on the public cloud. So we sit on top of the cloud giants. They're containerized. So therefore, they're quick and easy to maintain, and they're elastic. We don't need to worry about data center contracts or buying hardware and deploying them. But that gives us the power of those enforcement points wherever we need them.
One of the unique aspects about our points of presence, because it's a topic that if you're in the SASE or SSE market looking to partner with a vendor or purchase from a vendor, that's a topic that comes up consistently. One of the unique things we did, as Jay mentioned, we developed it really is cloud first. So cloud native approach in terms of development, DevOps, Agile, all those fancy buzzwords. What it comes down to is if we need to deploy a POP, we can do that in a relatively short amount of time. It's a matter of a Terraform script. 2 hours later, that POP is realized on infrastructure, and clients can start to use that and take advantage of it.
So are you then positioning your ZTNA approach as like a replacement for the traditional VPN client?
I think that simple answer to that is yes. But I guess it's more around the why rather than just giving you a simple yes answer.
We're going to have yes and.
I mean, VPN's been around a long time, 25 plus years technology. There's a number of things we see in the press and social media recently where they've been compromised, kind of those legacy vendors. There's a number of risks around VPN. So when we talk about them being attackable from the internet, obviously they're usually VPN concentrators or firewalls that are sat there on the internet and can be attacked remotely. And also with VPNs is when a user has a client and they connect, yes, there isn't probably an SSL tunnel from that client to that firewall or that concentrator, but then the user is an extension of the network. And what I mean by that is they get an IP address on the network, they can move laterally, they can go east-west, and either if that user has been compromised by malware or ransomware, they can spread it through that tunnel or over the LAN in WAN, or if they're a malicious attacker, there's very limited visibility through legacy VPNs, and they could therefore be sitting there connected to the VPN, constantly trying to hack onto the network. And that's really what ZTNA removes. Obviously, being built on top of zero trust, and it's that granular access of just user to application, you remove those risks of VPN. And John, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that.
Yeah, I mean, we see it in the news constantly. The major big box providers that have the sheet metal boxes that are the VPN concentrators constantly in the news with risks, has announcements out. Some of the major providers for security providers have challenges. So really what we're looking to do is remove that and leverage much more of a what we call ZTNA approach versus the VPN approach for security. So it's a major upgrade for folks out there.
Yeah, so one thing I guess I'm taking away from that is that unlike your traditional VPN, when I make that connection, I am essentially a node on the network. But with ZTNA, there's an extra layer that's limiting my access based on my role, my identity, my device posture, and so on, only to the applications I need, as opposed to being a VPN client where I'm like, now I'm on the network.
Absolutely. And you're also gaining the ability, if you're providing the service, to do SSL inspection at scale as well. So not just passing the packets through to the network, but actually inspecting them and allowing or disallowing based on policy.
You're talking about doing SSL inspection at the POPs?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's jump into some customer use cases. I think one of the ones you wanted to bring up is agentless ETA. I know we did mention there's a client, but you also have an agentless mode.
Yeah, obviously we've mentioned this is where the product started, really was around those risky third party and contractors, specifically because you don't have control over those devices. You can't patch them, you can't secure them, you don't know really what they're up to. So yes, we have a number of customers that use our agentless offering. Historically, what they were doing is provisioning actual corporate machines and sending them out to their contractors and their third parties. So they were spending $10+ million a year doing that because they needed to put an agent on the device and they needed to get those users access. What they've done is they've progressed with us to go down our agentless access route. Obviously, because it's granular access and it's just user to application, the risk has gone away from those machines. You don't need to have an agent tunneling everyone and putting them on the network. So they save that 10 million plus per year. Obviously, that increases their ability to roll out that really, really quickly within hours instead of days. It's a significant reduction in costs of shipping those machines because in a lot of cases, they were shipping machines and certainly during the pandemic, shipping them out. They would take several months to get there because of supply chain issues, and those contractors may have already left by then and they were not getting those machines back. So significant ROI, much better time to value. It was a win-win all around.
Yeah, I think one of the other points I'd call out is this is a great place to start to really get your feet wet with a ZTNA approach. Securing third parties is critical to an organization. More and more companies need those resources to make their business go, whether that's a contractor or somebody that they're partnering with, and securing them is hard to do. Agentless allows you to grant out, maybe it's 5 or 6 of those key applications to that third party, secure them in a least privileged manner, and also, you know, try out this new solution. So we see lots of companies coming to us. This is really their first step on that SASE SSE journey.
Okay. And just to be clear, because I'm agentless, the element that's mediating like a remote worker's agentless access is a POP again?
Yeah, we're a broker-based solution. So yeah, it's the POP that's doing the security.
Okay. So I just need a mechanism to steer them to that POP.
Exactly.
Okay. The second use case is a VPN consolidation. Can you drill into that with us?
Yeah, VPN consolidation. Really, as John explained, kind of the third-party and contractor access is stage number one. That's seen as a big risk. The next biggest risk on most companies' kind of roadmap is multiple VPNs. I've come from an environment and worked on the customer side in a company where we were very acquisitional. So it wasn't unusual that we would have multiple solutions from any of the companies that we've acquired. We would then have a solution for remote access, a solution for contractors, a solution for IoT access. Mm. And that complexity does not really breed good security design, right? So you've got all these tools, different ways of managing. If you have issues, you can't really see where the issues are because of lack of visibility. So people go on this journey of ZTNA and consolidate all of those tools into one ZTNA vendor. And I think that's really the driving factor that most companies are going on for that consolidation. We hear it all the time that people want to consolidate. And one of those key things is really all to do with that granular access and visibility. We had visibility when our users were on-prem. We lost that visibility. If you're looking at multiple tools from multiple different vendors, that's really difficult. So consolidating and have one place to look for risks and one place to look for audit and one place to troubleshoot is imperative, I think, for businesses.
Yeah, and this really speaks to the SASE SSE journey, because what you're doing is taking what in the past were multiple point products and consolidating them. And VPN's another area where, you know, the previous company I worked for, we had 4 different VPN solutions from 3 different vendors. And it was all about legacy. Legacy doesn't die. And for you really to go forward into this new era, you've really got to take a hard look at your portfolio, your network portfolio, your security portfolio, start to make some hard decisions and consolidate. And that's an area where we see, and Jay and I work with customers on that journey, starting to map that out, having them understand this is when we sunset this product, bring in this product, so on and so forth. So VPN consolidation, it's a hot topic these days.
So now the third use case is developers using ZTNA to give them access to dev, QA, and test environments. And I think that's interesting because, you know, sometimes developers can be a little finicky. And so you want to make sure that their access is not an issue for them because they get upset.
Yeah, it's really more about that. And this is one that isn't talked about a lot, but it's a very effective one and a very important one. In my previous role, I ran infrastructure for a large outdoor company. And this was one of the areas that we talked about a lot. How do we grant access to a dev, QA, and test environment, and also seed it with real data, not generally customer data, but real data, and make it So there wasn't the ability for that data to leak and get out on the internet. Mm-hmm. And we had to have QA testers come in there, leveraging laptops, Apple devices, could be a Windows device, various versions of it, various versions of browsers, and then also mobile devices. How do you do that at scale? So we worked with a customer, a large hospitality customer, on this, and that's what their need was. How do we test our websites so, you know, customers could leverage it, or actually our QA team could leverage it, but not expose, you know, free prod to the internet. Mm-hmm. So basically what they did is they basically leveraged a ZTNA bubble around their dev testing QA environment to create that digital twin or that sandbox environment, and then started testing it against various devices. A really great use case for them. It reduced their risk. They didn't have to basically go out and buy another dev environment, all the infrastructure, and another VPN platform. Exactly. They were basically able to replicate their prod environment in their dev and QA and leverage that with the knowledge that that data, that website wasn't going to be exposed to the general internet. So great use case. And we do see a lot of interest if we have conversations with the dev team.
And were you able to support sort of like developer tools of choice, browsers of choice, and so on with this approach?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. That's also important because they want to be comfortable where they're working.
Yeah. I mean, it really speaks to the, you know, SSE and SASE. It really isn't just all about enabling the hybrid workforce. It can be used for other areas as well.
So HPE Aruba Networking also has an SD-WAN solution. How does that integrate with the SSE, which is the, you know, POP-based cloud-delivered security services?
I think we have a number of integrations in play today. The first integration was being able to deploy tunnels into our cloud for secure web gateway from the SD-WAN devices. The next step in the integrations is to be able to go and virtualize and put those SD-WAN boxes in our cloud. So rather than get to the edge of the network and do an IPsec tunnel into our cloud for things like Secure Web Gateway, being able to go all the way into the cloud with SD-WAN, so being able to get that performance and that visibility to into those flows all the way. The next step is then to bring the connector technology that we have currently that is a lightweight virtual machine that is deployed on-prem, but being able to run that on our SD-WAN boxes as well so that you can have connector-less sites. Mm-hmm. And then being able to ZTNA over those IPsec tunnels or over those SD-WAN tunnels. So like I said, some of those are already in play today. Some of those are coming, but that means that we can offer a full SASE solution. John, anything for you?
Yeah, I would go even further than that. The vision really is this concept of what Gartner calls universal zero trust, mm-hmm. where the policies are extended from the cloud SSE solution all the way down to the switch port, the AP port. So therefore, that policy follows that employee, that user, that third-party contractor, whether they're working from home, from a cafe, in the office, all the way down to that branch or campus location. That's one of the challenges, is policy sprawl within security solutions. And just think about the SSE and SASE suite. You know, what products is it covering? It's covering remote access, covering Secure Web Gateway, CASB, DLP. That's a lot of policy to write. And we see that as a risk to organizations and an opportunity for us to come in and assist them and make that a lot simpler with essentially one policy engine to cover it all. So that's the vision down the road, is to extend ZTNA all the way down to the campus and branch location.
Okay, so last point before we wrap up, Jay and John, you're both going to be at RSA and you won't just be there talking about ZTNA. You've also got a fundraising scheme going on.
Fundraising scheme. No, actually, what we're doing is we've partnered with Chase Cunningham, also known as Dr. Zero Trust. We essentially had him on our podcast and we were talking about RSA. And the conversation came around to, hey, Chase, why don't we have you dress up as the, you know, true Dr. Zero Trust and bring the message of security to the, you know, cybercrime ridden streets of the Moscone. And he said, that's interesting, but I will only do it if you raise money for vets. So mm-hmm. he essentially made a bet. We've raised the money now. And yes, Dr. Zero Trust will be roaming the streets of the Moscone during RSA. So it's going to be very exciting.
That's awesome. And I guess you raised several thousand dollars to support veterans.
Absolutely. Yes.
We're currently at just over 5,000. So we could do with raising more if people are interested. But yes, that was the target.
Awesome. That's great. Well, we'll put that link in the show notes if people also want to pitch in. Any last thoughts before we wrap up? If folks want to find out more about HPE Rubin Networking and ZTNA, SSE, SASE, where should they go?
Yeah, we have a number of places you can go. Check out our website under SSE. If you want to contact myself or John, feel free to look us up on LinkedIn. We love all things Zero Trust, SASE, and SSE, and we're more than happy to connect with people and love having conversations just like this. Thank you very much.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you, John and Jay, for being here. And that website is arubanetworks.com/products/SSE, and we will have that link in the show notes that accompany this podcast. John and Jay, thanks again for being here, and to HPE Aruba Networking for being a sponsor. And of course, thank you for listening. We've got many more fine, free technical podcasts and our community blog. It's all at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on LinkedIn, hear us on Spotify, and if you would, leave us a rating on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.